Welcome to this episode of the Culture Inequality Podcast. My name is Gieselinde Kuipers. I'm a sociology professor from KU Leuven in Belgium. This is a sociological podcast that we've been making irregularly ever since the pandemic. But this is a very special episode. I'm extremely honored to have a very special guest star, Michelle Lamont. Michelle, can you briefly introduce yourself?
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here, Gieselinde. Thank you so much for inviting me. So I'm a professor of sociology and African and African-American studies at Harvard. A lot of my work has been based on large comparative studies focused on meaning making across class groups and racial groups. I'll say only this for now.
Yes, thank you. Well, plenty more to tell. But so Michelle also is one of the key figures in the study of culture and inequality, and an inspiration for me and many others working on this topic. Her name has come up in the podcast many, many times. But now she is with us herself to discuss how we can use sociological insights on culture and inequality to make the world a better place. A big question, and bizarrely, a question very rarely asked by sociologists. So we're talking about Michelle's new book, Seeing Others, How Recognition Works and How It Can Heal a Divided World. After four academic books and many, many research articles, are very influential among sociologists, but maybe not immediately accessible to normal people, this is Michelle's first book for a general public. Michelle, can you briefly tell me what the book aims to do?
The book aims to help people understand that we have good reasons to have hopes because we're moving away from the American dream to focus on a new vision for our society that is focused on inclusion.
That's a big aim indeed. Yeah. So Seeing Others is a remarkable book for many reasons, as we'll discuss in the next hour or so. But I think it's most noticeable not only for its attempt to bring sociological insights to wider audiences, but also for its optimism. After a rather grim introduction, you introduce an impressive cast of persons that have been involved in what you're creating, new recognition chains. So it's a book about how to create new narratives to create more hope. So before we continue talking about the book, I would like to ask you a question that has something to do with your motivation for writing the book. So the question I have, so your book is dedicated to your children. And I think, yeah, I've seen you give talks about this. So can you say something about how your children have made you inspired you to write this book?
This is such a nice question. So I have three kids, twins who are now 23 and an older daughter who's 26. And during the pandemic, like many Gen Zs, they were really struggling. Climate change is an enormous issue for that generation. And of course, they suffered isolation at the time where they really needed to autonomize themselves from their parents. So it was difficult. But what I've seen among my children and also many of their friends is that the American dream and the pursuit of consumption is not a very great motivation to figure out what they want for their lives. So I decided to do interviews with 80 Gen Zs from the Northeast and the Midwest of the United States, and also with cultural creators, people whose life it is to, whose job it is to create new narratives, to understand, you know, where we, when we look at the literature on hope, it tells us we get hope from narrative, you know, stories that allows us to imagine a different future. So that's exactly what I wanted to understand in this book.
Indeed, a personal as well as a professional goal, right?
Exactly.
So that's, so usually when I'm discussing the reading, so we ask the people who are there to explain what surprised the most. Mm-hmm. But I'm guessing the book doesn't have many surprises for you anymore at this point, but who knows? So, but maybe you could say something about what surprised you most when you were doing the research for this book.
Well, I should say that the interviews were conducted during the pandemic, which means that we were able to have access to a lot of people we would not have had access normally, very prominent cultural creators, you know, Hollywood creatives, very famous stand-up comics. And I think what we were able to see is how through a very wide range of people, they are focusing on increasing the inclusion of our society through very different lenses. So that goes from a person who was consultant on the soap Dove, that the company that made a campaign and featured a lot of large women in underwear, you know, which is basically about body acceptance and destigmatizing obesity. And of course, you have other groups that are focused on the destigmatization of queer people, of S&M people. You have corporate, you have economists who are also trying to create a fairer society, which also involves destigmatizing low-income people and, you know, also criticizing the focus on self-reliance, which is so central to American society. So I would say the thing that surprised me most is the many, many forms that all these knowledge workers and these cultural creatives are able to mobilize to push toward a similar objective, which is to create a more inclusive society.
Yeah. So indeed, the book takes on so many different things to recognize. That is really also things that I never thought about. I think that's really interesting. So I think I knew the Dove campaign, but also the other things. Indeed, anything from climate change to comics to diversity to S&M people. Indeed, anywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. But what surprised me most apart from this actually is that, so I have to say that the book is also strangely American in its interesting combination of optimism and individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also so, I also felt when I read it, I felt strangely European, thinking, it's all about these people, these individuals that have plans and initiatives.
Yeah, yeah.
And that it's also, it's really interesting. So that even when you talk about culture in this sort of European, so culture is something that, you know, individuals have and individuals do. So it's these optimistic change makers that go out there to do something.
Yes.
And I thought it's really interesting. So my sort of knee-jerk European response was to think, if you want to do this, you have to, organizations and plans and policies. So I think there is something interesting, and I think maybe we'll discuss this more. There is something American in the understanding that if you're looking for culture, you're still going to do this through individuals who have make this culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really striking to me.
Yes. And I should say one of the first talk I gave on this book was at University of Manchester. And after the talk, I had the conversation with a colleague there who kind of told me, it's so American to believe that change is possible. And also how intelligence is assessed across different countries varies a lot. And we discuss how having a very sharp, critical, and negative even mindset is a sign of intelligence in the UK. So we had this really deep exchange where, if you think resilience comes in part from feeling very agentic, then in some ways my book could never have been produced in the UK because it would be viewed, how can you be a smart academic if you're giving voice to people who believe that change is possible, So that was really interesting shock.
I think Europeans have a tendency to think that optimism is a bit shallow. Mm-hmm. That if you're sort of really profound, then you have to be a pessimist.
Exactly.
So smart people are supposed to be pessimistic.
Oh, yeah. And there are groups that cultivate this to perfection, like Hungarians or Russians,
The last thing you should do
is be optimistic.
That's just so shallow.
We don't want to engage in national character analysis, but
So on to the general discussion. So the big question that you ask in your book is the question that's actually the subtitle. So how can we heal divided worlds? Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very big question. And you start by explaining indeed how the world is divided. And as I said, the first chapter is a bit grim.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer you give to this healing is very briefly by forging what you call recognition chains. Mm-hmm. So what are such recognition chains? How are they made? And what are they good for?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Before I answer this question, I'll say a word about which divide I'm concerned with. The first book is about people above, college-educated professional and managers. And the second substantive chapter is about people below or people who don't have a college degree. And I argue that with the rise of neoliberalism, the first group, which includes probably most of the people who listen to your podcast, have become extremely valued, not only because we have college degrees and most of us are professionals or managers, but also because we demonstrate a number of virtues such as self-determination, self-reliance, orientation towards success, whereas the lower half of the population doesn't have that. And I say, in order to move toward a society where more people can prosper, we need to move toward a society that has a multiplicity of criteria of evaluation, where the neoliberal script of self is not as dominant. So people should also be valued because they are caring, because they, are spiritual beings, etc. There's other ways of creating a broader society. I must say also, before I go on, that the subtitle of the book was imposed to me by my publisher, How to Heal a Divided World, because she wanted the book to be in the self-help section on Amazon, which I found pretty not to my liking. But, I really pushed back. But frankly, I lost that one. What can I say? The self-improvement is the largest category in book selling. So I was not in a position to really push back entirely. As for your question about recognition chain, so this is really the idea that, okay, we have all these creators, like, for instance, Joy Soloway, who created the show Transparent, which became enormously popular, and it represents a middle-aged trans woman who has to negotiate with her children her new status as a trans, and it humanizes her because she's doing what many people are doing, negotiate good relationship with their kids, something that the general viewer can relate to. And when I interviewed Joy Soloway about what they were doing with this show, they said, I want to make trans people less abhorrent, more understandable. And I would say that is true about a lot of people that were interviewed for this book. But the notion of recognition chain is not only about the production of new narratives, it's also about scaling up narratives, which is why I interviewed, together with my research assistant, a large number of philanthropists or even people who own and have created means of cultural diffusion. For instance, Jack Conte, who is the creator of Patreon, which is an extremely important platform that has allowed many artists to, have their fans pay directly to get their music arrive in their inbox, once a week. I became, a patron of the wife of Jack Conte. Natalie has a band that is called Pamplemousse, and I'm now her patron. I gave her $5 a month, so her music lands in my inbox. So it has really allowed a lot of musicians to become autonomous from the radio stations that used to act as major gatekeepers. And the situation, the ecology of the diffusion of music has changed drastically. But we also interviewed Channing Donhay, who was at the time the vice president for global programming on Netflix. So she played a very important role. She was central in, for instance, diffusion of Black Panthers. She was very close to Ana DuVernay, who produced many very influential shows that gained popularity not only in the US, but also in Africa and in South Asia. So we're talking about the global diffusion of messages of inclusion as well.
So the chain, so this is actually where it gets out of the self-help, right?
Totally.
So it's not only about recognition, but it's the chain which makes it into a sociological thing or
exactly.
Social thing that connects.
And actually, I position myself quite strongly, very explicitly against positive psychology, which tells us, we have to celebrate kindness. In fact, I'm saying we need to create a world where we are surrounded by more cultural repertoires that will encourage people toward less individual. And what all the people we've interviewed are doing is, planting seeds for recognition in many, many places in our environment, to the point where it increasingly becomes less avoidable. So it's really a structural cultural argument, which is why the self-help aspect is so deceptive,
Doesn't really help. So that actually naturally takes me to the second question. So even though this is a really friendly and hopeful book, I think it has a few antagonists. Mm-hmm. So you actually critique, in a sort of friendly way, but it's clear that you're against several other disciplines, institutions, viewpoints that think about recognition.
Yeah.
So one obviously is psychology, but there are a few others. Can you say something about that? Who are you arguing against?
To push a little bit further on psychology, one thing that you and I share, Casilinda, is our concern about evolutionary psychology, because it has a lot of Darwinist assumption and many, many assumptions about human nature. And I feel very much that we don't know human nature. All we have are narratives about human nature, which have changed over time, but they are always only narrative. I think people who study human nature are a little bit like archaeologists. They work on figments, you know, tiny, tiny pieces of evidence from which they are trying to make huge extrapolations. So Jonathan Haidt, you know, many, many people who are studying polarization are starting with arguments about human nature. Also, people who study in-group and out-group presume that we are wired. Any explanation that starts with "we are wired to do X" for me is really not very credible, because we don't have much evidence of that. So that's one. Another one is economics. Economics, to the extent that I'm not attacking economics per se. I'm attacking the fact that they dominate the study of inequality so much, with a focus on distribution of resources. And I'm saying, if dignity is extremely central to subjective well-being, we need to consider dignity as well, you know, so as well as material resources. So a good sociology of inequality, I argue, should consider distribution together with recognition. So here I'm revisiting an old debate between Nancy Fraser and Axel Honneth about, you know, it's also a debate that has become more important lately with the publication of new book like Yasha Monk, The Identity Trap, where he really attacks any talk of identity and therefore recognition as attacking universalism, and also a dead end politically, that it's, you know, making, you know, really going to be very negative for the left. Whereas I believe that acknowledging the importance that people put on dignity is crucial to the victory of the Democratic Party, for instance, in 24. If the Democratic Party can figure out how to both acknowledge the seriousness of the Gen Z's concern about wokeness and about, you know, pronouns and bathrooms, at the same time as it acknowledges how important it is for white working class men who have been downwardly mobile to feel that the Democratic Party respect them, they might have a way toward a victory. And I think, you know, Trump has understood this very well and has been, you know, speaking to the workers in these terms for the last 7 years. So it's absolutely crucial that the Democratic Party realizes how damageable it is to not fully cater to the needs for dignity, not only among Gen Zs who want to have non-binary identity or whatever, but also to the working class men.
So being 2 days away from the Dutch elections, which also are very much about these sorts of
issues.
Cultural issues and about dignity and identity and recognition. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that's really important now for elections everywhere, where people are, I think, getting very nervous about what will happen. And yes. I think a simple understanding of inequality doesn't really help us to see what's going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Great. I'm glad you agree.
Yeah.
Especially since this weekend, in Argentina, the most far right candidate won. You know, it's one country. It's urgent.
It's a string of one country after another. And it's really clear that all these elections are about cultural issues and about issues like dignity. And
And I think
we agree, but not for a happy reason, maybe.
No. But also, I think trying to push the cat back in the box is no solution, because it's just going to be there. You know, I think there's just a lot of denial about this.
Yeah. So the antagonists, so the psychologists, the economists, the people that understand politics in simple material terms.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Also, I mean, some sociologists. Yeah.
I think, yes, I'm very influenced as a sociologist by Durkheim, to the extent that I'm thinking about the centrality of the, you know, classification system in which we live. So for me, I think we need to play on our strength, which is not the intracranial. It's really about, you know, knowledge and the meanings we produce in interaction, including how it gets encoded in our environment. You know, the influence of institutionalism is certainly very, very clear. So, you know, I think we should play on our strength and focus on that.
Yeah. So I think we actually immediately move from the sort of antagonists in academia to the antagonists outside of academia. We actually already went there. And I think it's interesting that they're connected very much in these days. I think it's also so you could say that people like Trump or also the new Argentinian leader, Milei, actually also are creating recognition chains, right?
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah. In my book, in our fairness, I'm not looking at the kind of recognition claims that are being made on the right of the political spectrum. I'm not looking at far right people. I say there's plenty of other books that are written on those people. I could not do everything in my book. So I focus on the liberal progressive to progressive spectrum. I do talk about working class men, referring in part to my previous books, The Dignity of Working Man, but also, you know, Holly Oakshield, other studies that have focused on this. And, but I hold a very strong line that dignity is something that all human beings need, and dignity is dignity. I argue against trying to create, you know, hierarchies of who has suffered the most and who needs most dignity. One of the nice thing with dignity is it's not like a cake where if you get half of it, I don't get any. It's more like something that we can all have at the same time. So it's not zero sum, and it's very important to fight against those who think that it is zero sum. Of course, it gets attached to resources. The people who are recognized more dignity have access to better housing, better schools, better jobs. But at the same time, I think we can do a lot to kind of try to dissociate what I call symbolic boundaries from social boundaries.
Yeah, it's really, so the issue of the zero-sum game is interesting. It's something that recurs in your work throughout. I remember actually reading your book, Money, Morals, and Manners, was the first time I heard about this, and you used it to critique Bourdieu, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's still, so maybe you can say something about this notion of the zero-sum game. Oh, so what it means, yeah.
you bring me back to my early years, where I remember I was a student with Bourdieu in the 70s, late 70s. And one of the things, I mean, discovering his work was absolutely mind-blowing. You know, I was in a seminar the year that Distinction came out, and there was so much to like about it. But also he kept, implying that people who were morally inclined were making virtue of a necessity. Basically, only losers would have moral inclination. And I think in all my books, I've really pursued the notion that no, symbolic boundaries, people who draw moral distinctions, take them very seriously. And it's not the strategy of a loser. There's a lot of winners who are using, like, the whole ideology of meritocracy is based on moral distinctions as well, you know, that people who have succeeded best did that because they worked hard, they were focused, they were not self-indulgent, etc. So yes, the conclusion of Money, Morals, and Manners was very much that Bourdieu had a Hobbesian vision of the world, which I think is totally baked in field theory, and it might have had to do with his own social trajectory coming from the province of France and going to the École Normale Supérieure in Paris and really, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid of the Grandes Écoles ideology without much distance. And me, your listeners may not know, but I'm French-Canadian. I grew up in a society that was deeply collectivist, and I grew up in a family that was deeply collectivist, which in some ways is very similar to Dutch society, you know. And I think there's this is a little bit like the human nature theory. You know, you can start with the assumption, as does social dominance theory, that we're all Darwinist, or you cannot. And I think this is not baked into any society. You know, we can all go both ways, and it's very, very much open-ended. And the social arrangement, the institutions we create, the cultural repertoires that surround us, it's a little bit like Weber says, you know, there are the rails of history that can send us in one direction or the other. And that's within our power as human beings. It's not predetermined.
So does it also mean that a society that is based on recognition would be more collectivist necessarily?
Possibly. I mean, to the extent that a more inclusive society, such as the one that I describe as emerging in the U.S., It, but not necessarily, because a lot of the promotion of individualism, of inclusion, is also done on individualistic basis, the right of the individuals to self-expression, to self-actualize, etc., the right to be who you want to be. So many people who promote this also promote authenticity, which is really a form of individualism, you know, the capacity to be who you want to be and to be truthful to your own self. So I think it's not necessarily baked in. But on the other hand, I think at the level of institutions, having institutions that distribute resources more broadly certainly do a better job at sustaining the dignity of a larger group of people. So it's, I would say it's a mixed answer.
I realize it's a big question. It's just, I think it's interesting that your book leads you to think about such big questions, because you make a very strong claim that something real is changing, that there's something really fundamental that really changes in the way that we've been thinking about, you know, what makes societies work and what makes human worth. Mm-hmm. And that it actually is a tipping point where the sort of neoliberal system doesn't work anymore. So, so if you ask the question, so something new is emerging, that's also, you know, apart from the facts, can we do something about it? It's also the, you know, like, you know, when something new is emerging, that's interesting and a bit scary too, right?
Yeah. And
you don't know what.
And there might be a plurality of model, like the argument that institutionalists have promoted with varieties of capitalism, you know. But I think there are people, sociologists like my colleague David Grusky, who's developing this indices of social health, which has to do with, you know, frequency of suicide, lifespan expectancy, but also interracial conflict on all kinds of dimensions. And the societies that score best when it comes to quality of life tend to be social democratic societies, you know, the Scandinavian societies. So one could argue that a lot of the indicators, if, for instance, you put a lot of weight on human rights, of course, all the Muslim societies are not going to do very well, you know. Of course, the indicators bias results in one direction versus the other. But they have a great deal of social welfare that is based on mutual, like the Muslim Brotherhood is a mutualist group, you know. They provide a lot of welfare support that is provided in the advanced industrial societies by the state. And in Lebanon, it's not possible because they don't have state capacity. So I think it's interesting.
No, it's a big question. So I think the big question that you ask is, so we were in a society, I think in Europe as well, in the US, where we move more and more towards this sort of singular dimension of what it means to be a good person. And I think society has been organized around that.
Exactly.
And if we're moving towards something different,
then
and it's unstable now, which I think it is.
Yes.
Then this might be a good moment for sociologists to try and sort of, you know, intervene, because when times are unsettled, you know, there is more space for a new.
Yeah, absolutely.
Visions. That's the argument you're making.
Yeah. Absolutely. And also, it's complicated. Tita Scotchball, my colleague here, has recently published a book which says, you know, as unions lost their power for the American working class, they turned toward a lot of different kinds of organization. And one of them is the NRA. They became very excited about
The National Rifle. So it's the National Rifle Association.
Exactly. Exactly.
A big American organization of people who like guns.
Exactly. Yeah. But some of them like guns because they're hunters. So it's not necessarily, but others like guns because they think the right to own guns is essential to American individualism. So it's a wide spectrum, but it really leans right because of the weight of the those who are defending the First Amendment. But all this to say, this indicates if more people join the National Rifle Association because they abandon unions, it really suggests a transformation of which institutions value, you know, matter for Americans. So,
yeah. Indeed. So I think the same argument, but that's for maybe someone else's book, same argument could probably be made for various European countries.
Oh, absolutely.
So I want to move from the antagonists to the protagonists of your book. So you and your team have spoken to two groups of people. So first, the people you call change makers, and then the Gen Z college students. So let's talk first about the change makers. So you already said quite a bit about them, different examples that you gave. But can you say a bit more about how you selected these people and how they make recognition change? Because there's so many different people that you talk to. Mm-hmm. So how did you select them? Where did you find them? Why those?
Well, I started by reading a couple of influential articles that had provided useful update of Habermas's theory of public sphere, which integrated the growing role of social media, but also the professionalization of social movements and of philanthropy. So there's a wonderful paper by Douglas Hartman at the University of Minnesota, and his co-author is named Evan Stewart. And it's a paper that came out in Sociological Theory, which really provides, you know, I think of it as field analysis. There's a number of organizational fields that are central to the production of meaning making in our society. And this, of course, includes cultural industries, but it also includes social movements, social media, corporation, philanthropies. So then based on this, you know, overlapping Venn diagrams that represent different fields of cultural production, I used all kinds of personal contact, but also contact with colleagues and others to do snowball sampling and to reach the people I wanted to reach. So I have a colleague here, Sarah Lewis, who's my colleague in African-American studies, who connected me with a number of Black photographers and queer photographers. So a section of the book is really drawing on their work, where they say that they try to provide much more multidimensional, human, dignified representation of these groups, including S&M people in Los Angeles, where I interviewed Catherine Opie, who's a leading photographer of those groups. So a lot of it was very improvisational, I would say, because I wanted to have people who were very influential, but I also, in some cases, depended on the networks of some of my research assistants. One of them had grown up in LA and had close friends who were tied to the, you know, to the world of entertainment in LA. So it required a lot of creativity. But again, as I said, since it was during the pandemic, we could really do interviews with a lot of people who would not have been. And the Harvard name, of course, facilitates. People want to be part of they wanted to be part of the project. So it worked out well.
Okay, so can you tell me, so you did some of the interviews yourself,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Can
and
you
I love
tell me
doing...
about the interview that you liked best?
Oh, I really like Camo Bell, who is a African-American stand-up comic who has had a show. He presents himself as a middle-class African-American who's married with a white woman and who's able to explain to middle-class whites what African-Americans are about. So on his show, one of the first episodes, he goes to Alabama and he interviews people who are in the Ku Klux Klan, and he gets them to really explain their worldview. And it's really, really fantastic. And he's a wonderful stand-up comic. So I did that one really early on, and I was really, really taken by that one.
Okay, so the question I have is interesting. So you interviewed all these people, but obviously, so they try to create recognition chains, but it's not always equally successful, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming some, like Transparent, I think is a really good example to show of a recognition chain that really worked, right? It's also a chain.
Yes and no, because later on, this person, Joy Soloway, was very criticized because it seems like one of the main characters of the show had engaged in sexual harassment, and it became very criticized in the queer community for not living up to its principle. And also that maybe I don't want to say anything that is untrue here, but there was an issue of how much, you know, there had been enabling. But frankly, this is in the context of a historical moment where there was, a lot of canceling happening in Hollywood for all kinds of reasons. So I cannot pronounce myself on whether or not it was correct. But, you know, sometimes there is a narcissism of small differences that kicks in. So just to give you an example, I gave a talk on Friday at a university in New York, and one of the queer people in the room started explaining how the slogan, "Love is Love," which was so central to gaining to the victory of same-sex marriage was viewed by many queer people as really offensive because it presumed that the only way gay people will be accepted is if they become standard and if they marry and have children. So really a kind of censorship of gay people who wanted to have a life that was not so conventional. So, you know, the question of how people become very refined in how they understand the conditions under which you're being labeled properly, which has all to do with recognition, you know. So if instead of people engaging in these wars of classification, think in terms of, okay, what's the social process at work? I think it allows us to get out of canceling culture. That's probably one of the implications of the book.
Yeah. So you already complicated a question that I thought was very straightforward, which I think is something that sociologists do right. So the question I had actually was, so indeed, apart from the classification wars, so, but I think you could talk probably about recognition chains that work, that are successful, and recognition chains that are not successful. And I think success usually works through classification awards, but could you say, looking back at the book, could you also say some of the recognition chains that people tried to set in motion that completely did not work? So could it be?
Well, the book includes a discussion of a paper I published with some graduate students in 2016, where we compared how people with HIV/AIDS experienced a reduction in their stigma. And we use a book by Stephen Epstein, who's a wonderful medical sociologist, to explain how this was made possible because of an alliance between social movement activists and knowledge workers, which included legal experts, medical experts, social scientists, journalists. And we compared that case with the case of people living with obesity, which is a case that failed. And here we draw on the book of Abigail Sagi, titled What's Wrong with Fat, and she shows how the medical experts refuse to advocate for this ideology of healthy at any weight that the militant, the social movement activists were pushing for. And they were, some of them were really, at the time she did her research, sticking with the BMI, which is now, I think, widely recognized as a very poor measure of what's healthy weight. And, you know, also things have changed since she published her book. Like now there's more of a recognition of genetics in affecting obesity. But the argument is, you know, the obese remained deeply stigmatized in part because it is associated with laziness and self-indulgence and not taking care of your body and lack of self-pride, etc. So
and with social class
and social class, of course, and education, you know, whereas there's another book by Joshua Gamson, which was about the depiction of gay people on talk shows. He argued that most of the gay people are present on talk shows are upper middle class men, you know, the working class men whose speaking skills are less sophisticated are often ridiculed on those shows. So anyway, so yeah, the representation of the group, I think the ideal typical gay couple is two lawyers without kids, you know, big purchasing
power.
Very
nice. Very nice tailored suits.
Yeah.
Well dressed.
Exactly. Yeah. And able to purchase very expensive real estate.
Yeah. So exactly.
Yeah.
No, I think it's an interesting, so I think it's also nice that your book is a research program in that way, that it sort of gives pointers for how to think about these things in terms of when something would fail and how it would succeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also one of the lessons of the book is that destigmatization has worked in the past for many groups. I give the example of same-sex marriage, of course. And therefore, it's in our power and it can work again. So that's also part of the message of hope, you know, that the instead of trying to reduce people's bias in their mind at the intracranial level, we can work toward destigmatizing groups or reducing their stigma, which is a collective accomplishment that is in our hands. So that's really one of the big takeaway of the book.
Yeah, so there are the psychologists again as the antagonist. So, but we were talking about the protagonist, right?
Yeah.
So the other protagonists are the college students.
Yeah.
So I think you already said why you talked to them, but what did you learn from them about recognition and recognition chains?
Well, we conducted two waves of interviews. The first, and I say we, actually, I did not conduct these interviews. I asked two of our wonderful graduate students to do this, Mary Sanchez and Shira Zilberstein. And actually, we have a couple of papers that the listeners can find on my website, published separately in Sociological Science and Social Science and Medicine, that look at the data much more in detail than I could in the book. But so we did a first wave in the fall of 2019. And then, of course, COVID started in March 2020. So we decided to re-interview them during the summer to see, you know, a lot of our questions were about how they understand their lives, how they imagine their future. There's this amazing literature that has been growing very rapidly in cultural sociology on how people are imagining the future. So we wanted to contribute to that literature, but also, given how they perceive their challenges, how do they imagine the society they want to live in? So, of course, that was deeply destabilized, I would say, by COVID. And many of them became much more focused on creating a more collectivist society, to go back to your earlier question. And that part of the research includes a comparison between the students we define as privileged, basically children of the college-educated parents who are professionals and managers and the less privileged. And we find very different patterns in those two groups, which is that the privileged students imagine themselves as leaders of social change. And for them, COVID represented a huge break with the past because they had never experienced huge challenges, you know. Whereas for the working class kids, many more of them would say, our life has always been challenging. My parents lost their job. You know, we were evicted. There's all kinds of stories. But they also say, I cannot be the leader of social change because I'm helping my parents pay their bills. I'm not going to be demonstrating day and night because I have some very concrete obligations. And also they had the middle class kids were much more likely to talk about kindness, how we all need to be nice together, whereas the working class kids were more likely to say, no, it's a power struggle. We need to fight. And that includes African-American students who were, you know, the second wave. We were interviewing them in the middle of Black Lives Matter. And they said, social change requires confrontation. So it doesn't mean being nice with everyone. Sometimes it means really calling out people and calling out their privileges if they're blind to it. So it presumes a very different understanding of how social changes can be achieved. But that I thought was very, very interesting. And what we found is that in general, these young people are extremely skeptical about the American dream. And when you ask them, what are you doing? They say, I want to live my best life now. I cannot wait 40 years because the environment is getting destroyed. I don't know how long I'm going to live. I'm certainly not going to spend the next 40 years saving money for a house. If, you know, especially if our houses and our lawns and our cars are destroying the environment. So I would say in general, they talked about consumption as being much less central to their lives. But I should say a lot of the literature on Gen Zs is really about middle class kids or college student kids. We know very little about those who are not in college. And actually, that's something I'd like to do in a future project to really try to get more data on the non-college educated Gen Zs and how they understand the future and how they can gain recognition through politics and other means as well. So
there's a lot of criticism on generational thinking in sociology.
Yes.
So many sociologists don't really believe in generations,
yes.
But you do, I think.
Yes. No, yeah. I don't. What I do is I totally acknowledge the criticism that demographers have formulated that we are unable to distinguish between age, cohort, and period effect. I mean, that criticism is self-evident, but I use the label Gen Z because this is a cohort that absolutely defines themselves as Gen Zs. And they also understand Gen Zs as having a lot of political agency. And they say, you know, we're in the cockpit now, you know, we're going to change the world. So in other words, my use of the term is really because of the intersubjective salience of the label for them, which means that they do act as a historical agent. You know, I think they do. They have enormous involvement. Like now in the US, we have a huge increase in unionization. And we know that a lot of this is happening in the service sector, where you have a lot of Gen Zs who were involved 3 years ago in Black Lives Matter, who are now creating, you know, leading strikes at Starbucks and at Amazon and at many other places. So I think they're self-understanding as a very political cohort who wants to fight for social justice is going far beyond race now to really affect what Gen Zs are looking for in the workplace and what kind of job they want, especially in the context of the Great Resignation, where employers are kind of forced to transform the workplace if they want to find employees, because, you know, since they don't care that much about consumption, they more easily, you know, resign from their job than the boomers did. So
really care. Yeah. So you see, it's interesting. So you basically define generation not as an analytical term, but as a cultural repertoire.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And a subjective reality for a number of people. This is a very salient reality. So you cannot say, because, you know, even the parallel with, let's say, the concept African-Americans, you could say there's no such thing, you know, but in fact, there is, if many people define as such. So it's a kind of classical, the Thomas theorem, you know, W.I. Mm-hmm. Thomas theorem, what is defined as real is real in its consequence. So that's the thinking there.
Yeah, I think it's also, I think also in Europe, I think there is a very strong sense among younger people now that they are, they're really different from previous generations.
Yeah.
So that theirs is a really different world. And I think it's also for me. So I've been teaching for quite some time, and this is the first time I see a generation of students or like, you know, people that I meet, they're really different.
Yeah. How do you see them as different?
Well, they're definitely more political.
Yeah.
So they're really very strongly concerned. So it's also, I think it's also a political, like, it's really like a political concern too. It's not only political activism, but it's like, you know, it feels like care and like very emotionally charged in a very distinct way. So they're worried and concerned and driven that way. And it's also, and they seem not very optimistic. I think that's also a very clear.
And I do think that the climate change issue is a huge challenge for them. You know, they really mean that it really transforms their worldview.
Yeah. So I think it's also the horizon of the future is really has a different form than a sort of endless up sort of.
You know. They don't know. Yeah. Literally, I think they don't know how long they're going to live, which is
which is distressing.
But
it's good. I think it's interesting to think about this. But I think also the creation of creating hope for a generation like this or for people like this is a different.
Yeah, and there's one.
It's a different challenge.
Yeah, and we haven't talked about the mental health crisis, which is extremely salient in the American context. You know, the feeling of hopelessness among a lot of young people. So, if their choice is total hopelessness or really finding meaning somewhere, whether through inclusion or anything else, they have to do it. You know, it's been a real epidemic, and we have ample data showing, you know, studying surveys that cohort after cohort, their mental health, and there's been steady decline for a long time. So this is a real problem. And I think it's tied to dignity and feeling of worthiness. So
there we have again, so the sort of the sociological countering of a psychological argument, right? If there is a mental health crisis, it's something that has to be countered not by pills or therapy, but by new narratives.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I think also your first question about I'm all for mindfulness and yoga and self-care, but I just think they're not enough, you know, that we have to think also of solutions that go beyond the individual. And that's where, you know, using the tools of sociology to figure out what would make a difference. That's the that's where hopefully it will make a difference.
Yeah. So it's actually, we're almost ready to go back to the central question, but I think, it's a very expansionist or almost cocky understanding of sociology here that you have no psychologist They are sneaking.
No, but I
and here is us. We're gonna do it all. So we are.
Yeah, but at the same time, like in relation to economists, I certainly recognize that, you know, we need to study distribution as well as recognition. And when I think about psychology, of course, we share a lot with psychologists. We share Goffman. We share focus on personal dynamics, you know, so I don't want to claim there's even in my building some wonderful scholars who study stigma and even categorization. So I think the disciplines are converging in many ways, but there's not enough dialogue for us to really understand how we are converging. And there's a number of sociologists that have really embraced the dual model of cognition, which to me, it's not the model that I prefer for a range of reasons. I've written about this. So I really want to support more exchange, but I think in around the questions that...
On your terms.
Yeah, you know, the questions that are more likely to be... You know, the nudging industry for me was a mistake from the beginning, you know, so I don't see why, because the impact of nudging are extremely short-lived. And we know even Mazarin Banaji, who has really promoted the implicit association test as a way to combating discrimination, is now very critical because, you know, showing, you know, images of Black people and white people and measuring how long it takes for people to make the association. It's proved to be, you know, you can maybe make people realize that, oh, maybe I'm a little racist because it takes me longer to, but that's not, it makes people angry. It's not organizationally. As you know, Gisela, and I should probably say this for your listeners, my husband is an organizational sociologist who studies which organizations have been most successful at increasing diversity. His name is Frank Dobbin. And what he finds is really that these tests are, you know, this is not the organizations that do best are not those who use these kinds of mechanics. It's more when organization that institutionalize mentoring program, where it's not only people of color who are in charge of telling everyone that racism is bad. It's when all middle level managers are in charge of creating an environment that is more inclusive. And I go a little further than Frank by saying it's not only creating an inclusive environment, it's creating an environment where everyone feels recognized. So I think we need to go even further than this literature suggests.
Yes, so this actually takes me back to the general question. So maybe the two questions. So I think the first question is the question that your publisher pushed upon you, but still maybe that we can answer now. So how to heal a divided world? Mm-hmm. And I think the question you add is actually what can sociologists do to be of help in healing this divided world,
which yes.
both really big aims. So you explained, I think, what you mean by that and the sort of program that you laid out. But then the final question really is, so what next? So what do we do now? Can we read your book?
Well,
and then what happened?
And I should also underscore that I'm having now published a trade book and realizing how difficult it is to diffuse ideas, you know, like in any one season, there's like 500 books published every week in the United States. It's very difficult to get people to read your book, you know, and the kind of arguments that we propose, not only me, but all social scientists, are really complex. When my publisher told me, you're aware that your readers don't know the difference between political science and sociology, it made me realize I really had to reframe how I think about my question. And I think my book is asking a lot of the reader. And typically, the book that ends up on the top of the New York Times bestseller list are books about makeup or about self-help. They're not as demanding. And it's very rare. One of my inspiration for this book, I have here at Harvard, Ziblatt and Levitsky, who published during the pandemic, Trump presidency, the book How Democracy Dies. And I thought that was an amazingly successful book because it gave the general readers the tools of political science to understand what was happening. And that really inspired me to do this book. But it takes a very long time, I think, for knowledge to percolate. And it's not an individual project. It's a collective project, I think. You know, I think it will take a lot of books that are you know, really mobilizing the knowledge of sociology. And it's already happening. Many, many of us are already doing it, you know. So it's a very slow process, the diffusion of idea. And we have wonderful sociologists. You may be familiar with the article published by Tim Hallett and Michael Sauder and their other authors. It came out in ASR 2 years ago, and it's called Public Ideas, and it traces how books such as Bowling Alone and The Second Shift and The Clash of Civilization and The Overworked American, how all these books diffused. And some of them, like The Clash of Civilization by Huntington, peaked very quickly and then declined little by little, and others had slow growth and slow diffusion. But I think we really need to think about these models if we want to use the knowledge of sociologists to understand how to put out there ideas that may help orient where our societies go. But, you know, you think Arlie Oxshield's book on Louisiana, which came out, now I'm blocking on the title, I'll send it to you later. You know, her book was Strangers in Their Own Land. That book, which came out in 2016, was extremely important in giving people the tools they needed to understand what was happening the year that Trump was elected.
Yeah. So indeed, so you list a number of books that have done this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting and also in a way hopeful that actually that there are books by sociologists that can be, even though all the books that you mention are complex.
Yeah.
Right. So none of these books is so, except for maybe Huntington, I have to admit, about all the other books, none of them is simplistic or has an argument that is a sort of a snappy 2-3 sentences.
That's true. And they all have a clear expression, like you know, The Second Shift, you know, it's mm-hmm. a few words that really capture what the book is about. That's crucial. I mean, this paper titled Public Ideas is partly wonderful because it really is a great analysis of the conditions for the diffusion of ideas. So,
and we also put it to practice. So it's another sociological idea that we can maybe use.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, but concretely, so this is a podcast that mostly younger academics, mostly in Europe, listen to. So what would you advise people if they want to sort of, you know, heal the divided world or work towards change or make sociology matter?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So what's the message? Yeah, sorry.
That is a big question, Gisalinda.
Yeah.
Well, I think many people come to our field because they want to change the world, you know, and they think very hard about this. And often they think hard about this because it's crucial to their own well-being and to their own conception of the society they want to live in. So I would say those are good reasons to be sociologist. And, you know, I guess I would say continue to do it, you know. And I think as I'm, you know, since I released this book, I've been asked to do things for business school journals where they ask me, what are the top 5 things that, you know, managers should do to improve the workplace? And my answer, I keep thinking, the answer is understanding, you know, gaining an understanding of how people's life go and, you know, what it is like to live in their shoes. And I think that's what a lot of us sociologists are doing, right? And I think it's a very worthwhile thing to do with our lives. So to younger sociologists, I would say they, you know, to really continue to focus on this is, I think, a very important. This is what we all do by teaching, by training other graduate students. I mean, I'm not a nihilist when it comes to sociology. I think what we're doing is very important and we should just continue to do it because this ecological model of knowledge diffusion, it's a little bit like 1,000 points of light, you know. These messages take many different forms and contribute to creating a world that may be more meaningful. So that's my view.
Okay. So thank you so much. So this is the end of the podcast. So again, I was super honored to have Michel Amand on the podcast talking to us rather than us talking about Michel Amand. Here is the real person from Harvard talking to us, not only about culture and inequality, but also about her new book, when she's proposing that we can actually use sociology to create new narratives and to create hope and to also think about how new generations can be addressed sociologically and understood. So I thought it was really amazing to have you around, even though it's not live. So what we usually do at the end of the podcast is ask if there is something in this conversation that you can't let go. Is there something that we discussed that will keep you thinking about this or will
stay with you? Yeah, I think the question you asked that surprised me most is the case where recognition chains fail. And I think I need to think more about this, especially now that we've had, you know, Roe versus Wade reversed. There's a lot of pushback now in the U.S. So I think it becomes even more urgent to think about those areas where we seem to be going backwards. So not very optimistic topics to think about, but I think I need to give it more thought. So thank you so much, Gisselinde.
Thank you.
I'm very honored.
So thank you. So the thing I can't let go of this conversation, I think there were many things in the book, but also in this conversation that really make me think through sociology again. But interestingly, the thing that really stays with me is the understanding of dignity also is something that doesn't diminish so that it's not a zero-sum game. I think that's really something that, so once you start thinking about this, it's something that many people, I think, would not see like this. Mm-hmm. So I think it's also like there's a lay theory where, you know, your honor is my failure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very strong logic in the same way. So your dignity is my loss of face, mm-hmm. or my stigma in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting to think of how sort of not only conceptually, but also practically, how you could sort of convey this to people, this understanding that dignity is something that actually so everybody can gain in dignity, and nobody would have to lose. And I think that's probably true empirically, but it's also something that I think many people would not believe to be true. Yeah. I don't really understand why that would be the case, or if that would be universal, or if this is somehow inherent in neoliberalism. So this is something that I think I'll be sort of thinking about.
Yes, and I should add that in sociology, since Bourdieu thinks of fields as relational, many people would say, no, it is zero sum because our positions are defined relationally. But our position can be defined relationally in a positive way. It doesn't have to be zero sum. I think if you're part of a group where everyone feels good about being part of the group and is supportive of each other, like in a cohort at school, for instance, it makes a very big difference for everyone. And everyone knows that it really stinks when it's zero sum. It's very hard to live. Same thing for the life in a department where if you have people who are not generous and are constantly looking at what other people have that you don't have, it makes life very difficult.
Life so miserable.
Yeah, exactly. So we have options. That's the good news.
Exactly. Okay. So thank you so much. So it was really lovely. I hope to continue this conversation sometime somewhere. Thank you everybody for listening to the Culture and Inequality podcast. So we're back after a long break. So Michelle was the first guest, but we have a few other guests, most notably Raul Perez, who will join us very shortly, who is the author of The Souls of White Jokes, the winner of the ASA Award from the Culture Section, which is a book about humor. So that's another topic that's very, very close to my heart. So we'll also be talking with Raul very soon. But for now, thank you so much, Michelle Lamont, for being here and for this conversation. And thank you, everybody, for listening to the Culture and Inequality podcast.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you. Goodbye,
Gisselinde. Okay. Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.